Hello and welcome to episode 15 of Plain Talking. In this edition, we'll be hearing from a woman who has fallen in love with wild swimming and has successfully navigated the North Channel. We'll hear disturbing news about growing religious intolerance in India, and Brother David Jardine will close with some thought-provoking words. Dr. Mary Self is a consultant psychiatrist who has faced many personal challenges. I recently caught up with her, and she spoke about her pleasure in swimming in cold waters.
So I was beginning to get some troubling symptoms about a few years ago, and I think it followed the bereavement of one of my siblings and also the COVID pandemic. I think everybody working in the health service experienced huge amounts of trauma and witnessed huge amounts of trauma. And I'd had these symptoms going way back a couple of decades ago following a cancer diagnosis, but I'd really sort of brushed them to one side. And I think I'd sort of cured myself really with distraction and just getting on with life. But 2 years ago, the symptoms emerged again and I began to get some really troubling nightmares and flashbacks of various traumatic situations that I'd been through. And also extreme anxiety, which really affected my functioning. I mean, PTSD stands for post-traumatic stress disorder, and it is a group of symptoms that you can get after experiencing life-threatening trauma. So I recognised the symptoms and was diagnosed. And I suppose at the same time, I had a holiday to the Lake District. And it was quite early on in the year. It was February, in fact. So it was very cold. And I was feeling in a really bad place with, you know, really bad anxiety and quite low mood, which can accompany PTSD. So I don't know. I just was one day I thought, well, I'll have a swim because there was a lake in front of me. It was beautiful. It was, although it was a very cold day, it was actually a very bright day, with snow on the hills and everything calm, beautiful. So I went for a swim. And it was quite remarkable that really as soon as I got into the water, which was very cold, I experienced a real peace, or changed something within me. And I enjoyed it so much and I felt so much better that I began to do that regularly. So, I mean, I've always been a swimmer. I've always been quite a good swimmer and took lessons from a very, very early age. But I'd never really focused on outdoor swimming. I'd been more of a pool swimmer. And then if we went on holidays, yes, you know, I'd enjoy going in the sea, but I certainly wouldn't have gone in the winter or attempted anything more than sort of a couple of lengths of the pool. But after this, I began to really take it seriously and start swimming further and start swimming in throughout the winter. And it was just brilliant. And it really, really took my anxiety levels down, really helped my mood. And there was just something about it that calmed me down. So I continued to swim. And then around the same time, I was approached by just a guy on Facebook who was a swimmer. And he told me that he was an amputee swimmer like myself. I'm an amputee following a diagnosis of bone cancer many years ago. And he told me that he was trying to put together a relay team to attempt a challenging swim. When I queried what this swim was, he told me it was the North Channel. Now, I didn't really know very much about the North Channel at the time. So I went away and looked it up and I was like, realised that it was actually swimming from Ireland to Scotland. So a very big challenge and it's quite notorious as a piece of water because it contains lots of jellyfish. It's very, very cold and the weather can be very unpredictable. So it was no small feat to consider doing this. But I asked a few people, do you think I can do this? And they were all like, absolutely, give it a go. So he got together a relay team and of five people and we were all amputees. So this was his challenge, his idea. And what he wanted to do was to be the first full para relay team to cross the North Channel because it hadn't ever been done before. So I'd never met any of these people. We started meeting up on Zoom to kind of get to know each other, to talk about the challenge, to talk about our training, and to talk about the process of how you do this. It's a bit like when you swim the English Channel, there are pilots that take you across because it all has to be done very safely. So we found a pilot company that would take us across called Infinity Swimming, and we started training for it. And I think all of us thought it was a very big challenge. And I think we started off thinking if we can pull this off, it will be amazing. And yeah, lots of training, lots of swimming every day, lots of swimming in cold water, lots of pool training. And as I trained, I just began to feel stronger and stronger physically. But actually, for me, it wasn't so much the physical challenge, it was the mental challenge of facing something that it was quite a scary thing to face. I guess, as I always do, when I'm confronted with something really challenging in my life and really that could be quite scary, I look to my faith and I draw on the strength I get from my faith. So I did start to pray about it, and I started to kind of focus on Bible verses that were looking at fear. And one of my favorites has always been the verse from Isaiah, "Do not be afraid, you'll walk through the waters and I'll be with you." There's also a well-known worship song that is based on that. It's basically "No longer a slave to fear." And in part of that worship song, there's a line that says, "I'll split the sea and you can walk right through it." So myself and a group of friends who were praying for me kind of slightly adapted that to "I'll split the sea and you can swim right through it." And that became my song for when I was swimming. One of the tips that somebody gave me was when you're swimming and you're tired and you know that you've still got a long way to swim, have a song that you can link into and you can run through your mind. So this was my song, "No Longer a Slave to Fear." And I'd listen to it, I memorized the words so that even if I was feeling anxious, I could just almost sing that song in my head. So that became my swimming song, which was brilliant. So yeah, we had to do a qualifying swim. So we had to do a 2-hour swim to make sure that we were up to the swim. Also, we had to have a medical to say that we were physically fit to do it. And then in June, I traveled to Northern Ireland, to Bangor on the Northern Irish coast. We had what they call a window, so you wait for the weather to be acceptable and the tides to be acceptable, and you basically wait for the call. Now, when we got there on a Saturday, the weather was absolutely terrible. I mean, it was shocking. And there were storms and the waves were massive. And we just looked at each other and we were like, okay, this doesn't look good. And in fact, the weather forecast was for it to be like that all week and to be very rough waters. So we all kind of felt a bit nervous that we wouldn't be able to swim at all, because clearly there are conditions that it wouldn't be safe to swim in. So we started talking about, well, if we don't get to swim the channel, what can we do as an alternative challenge? Because we'd all prepared so hard. And I remember messaging my friends who were praying for me. I got a little WhatsApp group together just to pass information, but also for prayer requests. And I told them, I don't think we'll be able to go this week because the weather's too bad. It will be too dangerous. And one of the ladies in our prayer group, Helen, said, well, Jesus calmed the storm, so why don't we pray for calm waters? Now, I've prayed for miracles of healing on many, many occasions, but actually I've sort of never prayed for a physical miracle, as in, Father, please change the weather, because in some ways it seemed a little bit of an indulgent prayer, you know, so that, well, can you calm the sea so that I can go for a swim, basically. But I don't know, I just thought, well, yeah, that is a test of faith, so let's pray that. So we prayed for several days. And then on the Tuesday, the team before us messaged us to say, the channel's gone really calm, we're off, you know, we've had the call to go. So they were swimming before us. So they swam and they sent us pictures from the boat. And it was just remarkable that the water had gone from this raging turmoil to being like silk. It was beautiful. So we carried on praying, Lord, please, can the weather continue to be calm? And then that evening, we got the call to say the weather's going to be calm again tomorrow. We're leaving at 4 a.m. in the morning. it was a very short night that night. We arrived at the channel and basically you get on the boat, they take you to the start, and then we were swimming in a relay. So one person would swim for an hour and then we change over. There were five of us, so we did an hour at a time. And again, we got out onto the water and it was just so calm. It was like literally like, well, not like a mill pond because it was a lot bigger and a lot more turquoise. It was like smooth satin. It was beautiful. And the guys on the boat who were piloting us said, we've never seen the channel like this. It's never this calm. So I kind of knew that it was a real answer to prayer. And I told them on the boat, I said, I've been praying for the weather to calm. And it has. So they're a bunch of Irishmen who, I'm not sure they knew quite what to make of it, but that's what happened. So we swam and it took us 15 hours in total. So we swam three times. It was absolutely stunningly beautiful. It was so peaceful out in the ocean, and we saw some amazing wildlife as well. We saw some whales and some dolphins, and there were amazing seabirds. And the jellyfish left us alone, which was another prayer request that I'd asked my friends to pray for, because that was actually the thing that I was most scared of. I wasn't scared of the cold because I'd done lots of cold water swimming, and I wasn't scared of the challenge, but I was scared of the possibility of being stung by these jellyfish, which are very fierce jellyfish. They can give you a very, very nasty sting. And I didn't get stung at all. And in fact, we only had one sting of the five people who swam, and that was quite a mild one. So certainly for me, the jellyfish didn't like me. Again, that was another answer to prayer. And yeah, we achieved it. We swam it in 15 hours and 8 minutes. And it was the first time that a team of para swimmers have done that. So it was a world first to cross the North Channel as a team of amputees. Our team name was Team Bits Missing, which everyone found quite amusing.
Caroline Duffield works for Open Doors, who campaigned for religious freedom across the world. Caroline knows a great deal about the situation in India and the growing dangers facing people who convert from one religion to another. Well, I'm delighted now to be joined by Caroline Duffield, who is a writer and researcher with Open Doors and something of an authority on India. Welcome, Caroline.
Good afternoon. Hi.
For those of us who maybe just pick up pieces of news about India occasionally in the media, we may have in mind a rather more tolerant environment than the one that's actually now being presented. So, I mean, could you explain to us what is actually going on, particularly for Christians in India at this time?
It is extraordinary, Geoff, and it really is. India has this sort of shining economic record, this extraordinary record of achievement, and it does have a very plurulent, very open, tolerant constitution. That's the 1947 constitution, which is the vision of Gandhi, obviously. And Article 25 of that constitution guarantees freedom of worship, freedom of faith, the right to profess and propagate any religion you choose. And yet we are seeing these sharp rises in religious violence in India. And really, it is linked to these incredibly controversial laws, which people are calling anti-conversion laws. And I'll have to take you right back to 2014 and really the accession of the BJP into government in 2014 with Narendra Modi to explain the introduction of these laws. What they are is the idea, and supporters put forward this idea that there is somehow mass conversion taking place in India, that people are being converted away from Hinduism, converted by deception, converted by force, converted by allurement, by which they mean bribery. And this idea has seized the minds of a very significant number of people, and with some quite alarming consequences for religious minorities, not just Christians, but Muslims, Buddhists, Jains, Astrozaurians. All religious minorities in India are affected by this, but Christians and Muslims the most.
the way this works, I guess, Caroline, is that if you're born into a certain faith, then the idea is you should stay within that faith and have dealings with religious conversation with people of your own faith. But if particularly you, let's say, are a Hindu who might convert to Christianity, that becomes, and if you're the Christian who's involved in that conversation, this law then kicks in quite brutally, I would imagine.
Yes, the laws exist in 12 states, the anti-conversion laws, and they vary state by state, but various penalties are attached to them. So in some states, somebody who is converting away from Hinduism actually can lose their welfare benefits. In other states, there are very serious legal hurdles for young couples who are seeking to marry. If there's a mixed faith couple, they have to jump through a lot of legal administrative hoops to do that. In other places, in Karnataka state, there's been reports of government officials actually going door to door, knocking to check for families that have converted away from Hinduism to Christianity. It seems to be based on a slightly paranoid idea that there are people conducting mass conversion. And I should be clear and say there is no evidence to suggest that. The demographics within India remain very stable, but this idea is out there. And really, I think we have to look at the history of the BJP. The BJP is a religious Hindu party, and it sinks its roots deep into the soil of a radical group called the RSS, which goes back 100 years. And the RSS has a very angry majoritarian view of India, that India is India for the Hindus. The idea is that to be an Indian, one has to be a Hindu. That is the view of the RSS. And it is really the rise of what's called Hindutva ideology that strongly discourages anyone leaving Hinduism.
And it's worth saying as well, Caroline, that India is number 11 on Open Doors' World Watch list. So it is actually one of the most dangerous places to be a Christian on the planet at the moment. So and these initiatives you're talking about are probably contributing to that sense of danger and persecution that many Christians are facing.
Yeah, we're seeing India go through a real struggle for its future, I think. And it is. It's number 11 on the World Watch list, which, I mean, it's not North Korea, it's not Afghanistan, but the numbers of people being attacked in India are very significant. Just the last reporting period, the last 12-month period of 2022, in which Open Doors compiled its methodology, there are records of 75,000 Christians attacked in India. All their physical property was attacked. So that's people attacked, all their property attacked, their homes and shops. There were 67 churches that are either vandalized or shut down forcibly, and 17 murders linked to religious hatred motivations. So that's in one 12-month period, and the World Watch List figures are very, very cautious. We're very stringent and very small-c conservative about what we record as a religiously motivated attack. So the numbers are alarming, and really, I think it is fair to say that Christians and religious minorities in India are really living in a state of fear right now.
And finally, Brother David Jardine wonders why sorry seems to be the hardest word to say.
I'm sure that during his ministry, Justin Welby, the Archbishop of Canterbury, has taken part in many memorable occasions. But I suspect that May the 6th, 2023, leading the service for the coronation of King Charles III, was the biggest of all. I felt that it was a wonderful service, God-centered, from start to finish. And the Archbishop of Canterbury was right there in a leading position, including preaching a short sermon. That service must have been the highlight of his ministry. So the contrast could not have been more noticeable when just 4 days later, the Archbishop spoke in the House of Lords. He was expressing his opposition on moral grounds to the plans the government has for the boat people coming across the channel, being transported in planes to Rwanda. But he went further. He said, in expressing his sorrow about the evils of slavery, that the Church of England was going to offer £100 million in reparation to countries which had suffered most. For all of this, he was very heavily criticised. His detractors said that if he was opposed to the Rwanda scheme, he was making no suggestion as to what should be put in its place. I don't know if the Archbishop was right in all the practical suggestions he made, but I do know that he got one thing right. He was stating a principle that Britain was one of the leading players in the whole area of slavery. Not only was he sorry about that, but he was trying to show that he was genuine in his feelings by offering to do something practical about it. It took courage for the Archbishop to take that line, but he knew he was going to be heavily criticised. But what struck me was the fact that he was prepared to say sorry. I don't hear too many people saying sorry today, even when they're in the wrong, yet it is a fundamental biblical principle. Saying sorry to God and to someone whom we may have offended. When we do this, guilt can be removed, peace restored, and even healing take place. I've seen this many times in my lifetime. I remember nearly 40 years ago being at a meeting about Christian work in prisons in Northern Ireland. I was working at that time as Church of Ireland chaplain in Crumlin Road Prison in Belfast. Also at the meeting was Dr. Bill Holly, who was medical officer at McGilligan Prison in the northern part of Northern Ireland. Bill was a kind and gracious Christian man who took a weekly Bible study in McGilligan Prison. The men loved him, so it came as a surprise when Bill lost his temper with me in the meeting over something I said. Afterwards, I didn't think very much about it, but Bill obviously didn't forget. Next day, I was in Crumlin Road, and a phone call came through to me from McGilligan Prison. It was Bill Holly, apologising profusely for the way he had spoken to me the night before. I didn't feel he needed to say sorry, but Bill felt that he had to. Before that encounter, I considered Bill a great man, which he was. After that interaction with him, I thought he was an even greater man, having courage to humble himself before me. In our world today, there seems to be a breakdown of relationships at all sorts of levels, and it causes a great deal of trouble and heartache. If we could just recapture the courage and humility, because it takes both to say sorry when we are wrong, that in itself could go some distance to healing those relationships. Saying sorry both to God and to other people can help to bring healing and restore our peace.
Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed this edition of Plain Talking. If you have enjoyed it, then please subscribe to it and leave a review. Plain Talking is sponsored by The Plain Truth, a magazine of understanding. For more information, please visit plain-truth.org.uk. That's it for now, until the next podcast drops. So until then, God bless from all of us at Plain Talking.